Hello, everybody, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. David LaTulipe is the usual host, but he's not here this week, so I'm sitting in for him. I'm Leah Garchek. And today we will be talking first to David Finkel, who is founding artistic director of music at Menlo, which is in full swing already. He'll tell us about that. This is its 17th season, and the theme is Incredible Decades. Then we're going to be talking to playwright Carol Lashoff and director Elizabeth Vega. If she allows us, we'll call her Libby. They're doing the world premiere of Witch Hunt at Those Women Productions. And Witch Hunt is a phrase we certainly hear a lot these days. So this is hearkening back to Salem and that infamous era. And third, we'll be talking with Amy Mueller, who is leaving the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. She's been director after 19 years, and the Playwrights Festival is also underway. And playwrights Candace Jones and Christopher Oscar Pena will be here, too. And finally, Open Air's regular critic at large, Peter Robinson, is going to be talking about some movies, one about Pavarotti, Late Night with Emma Thompson, and then The Spy Behind Home Plate about baseball. But first, let's hear this relevant music. And that music is in celebration of today, which is the 147th birthday of Julius Fučík, known as the Bohemian Sousa. So you've probably heard that and have images of clowns and circuses and happy things. And before we go to David Finkel, I just want to say a big congratulations. I'm going to just say on behalf of the whole show, including the producers and the board ops and David LaTulipe, to Michael Tilson Thomas and Linda Ronstadt, who this morning, the announcement this morning was that they will receive Kennedy Center honors in December. And we in the Bay Area, there are five honorees, two from the Bay Area, so we're very proud. Okay, now we have our first guest is David Finkel, who 17 years ago came aboard at Music at Menlo. You were the founding director, so you created this.
Yeah, that's correct, along with my wife and pianist partner, Wu Han.
And how did it get to be here?
Well, we had some very great and promising seeds to plant somewhere for a chamber music festival, and we looked for the most fertile ground that we can find. We looked quite a lot across the United States, but somehow landed here and found that the Silicon Valley area was in need and very, very interested and supportive of the idea. So we tried it, and with some local support and wonderful initial board members and individuals and the Hewlett Foundation, we managed to get it going, and we're still, as you said, running strong.
And it got you. You live in Manhattan, yes?
We live in New York City.
So it got you out of the summer heat.
Oh, it's the most wonderful place to be in the summer, not only for the weather, but for the people and the community. It could not be more welcoming, more stimulating, and more productive.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's a great endorsement. 17 years ago, when you founded the festival, what was your vision for it? And has that changed, or have you fulfilled that vision or altered it?
We started with a full-blown festival in our first year that had educational events, that had a program for young musicians, that had lectures and full, of course, main stage concerts. Since then, our format has enriched itself, if not expanded beyond a longer period of time. Our three-week run is about just the right length, because during that time there's a lot of content. And our mission is to of course, not only to present world-class performances of great chamber music, but also to engage a wider audience and to deepen the appreciation of an existing chamber music audience to the point where chamber music becomes their classical music of choice.
Mm-hmm. In the 17 years that you've been having this series festival in Silicon Valley, in Menlo, which is in the heart of Silicon Valley, the audiences there must have changed.
I think so. I get, after every festival, people will come up who've been many years and they say, this was the best festival yet. How are you going to top it? It's always a very nerve-wracking thing, but I figured it out this year only that I think what's happening is the festivals, yes, they're always good, but I don't know that they're changing that much. But I do think our audience is changing. I think
and
our
that's
regular.
That's what I wanted to ask you about. How are they younger?
Yeah,
or are they...
I think they are always younger. They have to be, otherwise they wouldn't be there. But they're listening more deeply. They're more engaged. They're more anticipatory. They're better educated about what the music. And you know, I mean, knowing more about anything makes it more enjoyable, whether it's wine, food, baseball, or classical music.
Yeah. So let me just ask you one thing before we listen to some classical music.
Yes.
This year's theme is Incredible Decades.
Yes.
So it's a series of main stage performances that from seven different periods, yes?
Exactly.
How do you choose a theme, and how did you choose this one, and how did you choose your seven decades? That's a lot of questions.
You know, some people are shocked to hear that what we call classical music, especially the chamber music genre, covers over 300 years of music. There is a ton of it. It's like a gigantic pie. And you can't eat it all at once. You can't eat it all at once in 3 weeks. And you can't even eat it all at once over a whole lifetime. So we have to figure out ways to attack this pie and taste it in sensible ways. I mean, you know, making a program of music or making a festival is very much like being a chef or running a restaurant. You know, you pick the finest ingredients, you make sensible combinations of them, and you look at the end of the day for your customers to have had a wholly satisfying, sometimes enlightening experience. Gastronomically, and also we do that musically. So looking at this wonderful mountain of art that we have to choose from, there seem to be endless ways that we can cut this pie and serve it year after year.
Mm-hmm. And some years, have you learned from past festivals what works and what's likely to be most fruitful and hang everything together and keep people's interest?
We do switch our menus around with great care and with great respect for what our listeners have experienced in recent years, what they may have never experienced. Certainly that's a worthwhile pursuit, is introducing new listening experiences to people, whether it may be music that they've never heard or combinations of works that have never been tried. I might mention, just in terms of those combinations, there's a very interesting concert coming up on Saturday evening, the Finnish pianist Juho Pojonen, who is really one of the young stars of the piano these days with a truly international career, is bringing us a program of two composers who are not known for chamber music, the French Baroque composer Jean-Philippe Rameau and the Russian iconoclast Alexander Scriabin, who lived kind of in the age between Tchaikovsky and Prokofiev and was one of the most certifiably crazy composers in all of classical music history. I will leave it to readers and
competition
and people with internet access to even read a few sentences about Scriabin to learn that he totally went over the deep edge. But in going to places that are incredibly unusual, as Beethoven did in his late years, they bring back with them and they leave with us music of sometimes incalculable wonder and beauty. And this is what Scriabin did. So Juho, in this series that we call Carte Blanche, because we program heavily these festivals, Juan and I direct it, we program every piece, but artists these days are not only great players, they're also great programmers. They're great recipe makers. And we allow these artists, like like Stephen Prutzman and Tara Helen O'Connor, who are playing a flute piano duo, Carte Blanche, near the end, to come up with programs that, God help us, Wuhan and I would never think of them. We can't think of everything.
Yeah.
And so they come to us with these amazing ideas. So these two Carte Blanche concerts, I recommend them highly because you won't hear these programs anywhere else.
Well, let's listen to a little sample of Juho Paljonen playing Grieg's To Spring, which is, I took the easy way out and said To Spring, but it's actually Till Varen. I'm not sure I'm saying that correctly. But this is from a Live at Menlo album, and that was recorded in 2010. It just takes us to another place, doesn't it? Sitting here in the studio and listening to that, I can. So, you obviously meticulous care goes into planning a very complicated schedule of how many concerts are there? How many performances?
I haven't actually counted. I know that we have seven what we call main stage programs, which are this year the seven particular decades that we selected. But in addition, we have the Carte Blanche concerts. We have our prelude performances performed by our international performers. We have the Corette Young Performers concerts on Saturday afternoons. There's a lot of things. There's lectures. There's too many events. There's master classes. There are cafe conversations. Every day is packed.
Are there unplanned moments of beauty and surprise and awe for you?
You know, these festivals go down on paper. They come out of our heads. They are researched. They go down on paper. And they sit there on paper for a couple of years. But I have to say, from the time that the musicians show up and you see them in flesh and blood and you hear the first notes that they play, the dimension increases tenfold of what we're doing. It becomes that magical moment that you just mentioned is indeed when the festival comes to full life and rises off the brochure paper and out of the computers into real sound and real people.
Oh, thank you. That's wonderful. And especially after hearing the music, it just makes you want to be there. So if you listening want to be there, Music at Menlo began on July 12th. And it's going to August 3rd. There was over 50 events. Actually, I had that written down. I asked you, and I could have just looked down. At three stages in Atherton and Menlo Park. You can find out more on the website. And if you love music, you'll want to be there.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The heavens do declare.
The heavens do declare.
The majesty of God.
The majesty of God.
Also the firmament shows forth.
Also the firmament shows forth.
His handiwork abroad.
His handiwork abroad.
The heavens do declare.
The majesty of God. Also the firmament shows forth. His handiwork.
Okay, that beautiful music is from early American psalmody, the Bay Area Psalmbook, music from Cambridge in 1640 and performed by the Margaret Dodd Singers. So the sounds were beautiful, but these poor witches were having a really tough time. So we're here to talk about Witch Hunt, which is playwright Carol Lashoff is here, and Elizabeth Libby Vega. May I call you by your first names? Is that okay?
Shall just I call fine. You?
Please.
Libby?
And they're doing a performance of Witch Hunt at Laval's Subterranean Theater in Berkeley, which opens tomorrow and runs through August 4th. So your company is called Those Women Productions, yes? So
yes.
Tell either one of you, tell how that came about.
Carol, back in the day, wrote a letter, a very angry letter, to a local theater company who had brought in an all-male season. Is that correct, Carol?
That is true. I didn't know you were going to go that far
back.
But go ahead.
And unbeknownst to her, she became known as that woman who wrote that angry letter. And we met about 5 or 6 years ago. And when we decided to form the company together, we were so excited that neither one of us was the only that woman in the room anymore. Now there were two of us.
Oh, it's a club. I want to join.
Please do. We'd love to have
you. Oh, great. So the plays that you produce are about gender, power. They're all about women's issues.
Gender and power, which does not mean only about women's issues.
Of course. Yeah.
Elizabeth and I were drawn together by a mutual love of classic literature and intense frustration with the voices that were left out. And that's a pretty unusual mix in our experience. So it was that connection that made us want to form a theater company. And we are very interested in telling stories from points of view that are typically unheard, often familiar stories, classic stories, the story of the founding of the Western justice system. We work mostly with contemporary playwrights, with women, transgender playwrights. Have we done a cis male playwright?
We're only five years old. Give us time.
So you might break that glass ceiling.
Yeah.
That
but our focus ceiling. Is more thematic than it is identity-based.
So, and what about this story, which is well-known in certain aspects and to historians of Western civilization or anybody that's visited Salem, Mass, or what needed to be retold in another light?
You want me to take that one?
Go for it.
This is Carol speaking now.
Hi.
Who wrote the play?
Actually, I've never been to Salem, Mass, and probably if you've been to Salem, Mass, you have imbibed a lot of myths. And if you have read The Crucible, you have imbibed a lot of myths. And in fact, most of what's in the popular culture is a gross distortion of what's in the historical record. Most of us think of Tituba, who was the first person to confess to witchcraft and got that whole thing going, really. Most of us, until recently, I started doing this research, think she's African. If you read Arthur Miller's The Crucible and believe that as history and not just as a fantastic representation allegory for the McCarthy hearings, which it is, but as history, it's not real accurate. Miller portrays Tituba as a kind of 1950s black mammy. And most likely, she was an Arawak Indian woman from somewhere around maybe Venezuela, who was kidnapped as a child and sold into slavery on Barbados, where she was purchased by the minister, the man who would become the minister in Salem Village. He also purchased another slave who was apparently North American Indian, only known in the records, historical records, as John Indian.
How did you research all this?
Well, all the original archives, transcripts from the testimony, all of those are online. You can find them easily by Googling. So I have a big advantage that Arthur Miller did not have. You know,
it's
I
a startling leap, isn't it, to go from 1640
yes.
to
But you can read Tituba's confession. You can read the depositions. You can read Samuel Parris, the minister's sermon notebooks. All of the original records describe Tituba and her husband John as Indians.
Are there any images? Is there any imagery? Were there paintings or?
No. I mean, nothing that goes back. Nothing that's, you know, convincingly from that.
So did you two have an agreement? Did you talk about how you wanted to cast the role, Livy?
We had some discussion of that. Carol is obviously the playwright and worked it all out, but we collaborated a lot over the course of the writing of the script, looking at which parts we wanted to emphasize, which stories we wanted to tell. And one of the things we did was to discuss actors who we could picture portraying different roles. And I don't know if we cast any of the people that we were talking about, but it helped us get a sense of what kind of people they are, if we could imagine what kind of people might portray them.
We did have pretty heated discussions between ourselves and with our advisory board about how to post the audition notice in a way that would appeal to the actors that we wanted to find, how to describe it. And we describe ourselves as practicing activist casting, meaning it's not colorblind, it's not gender blind. We're looking to find actors who will bring cultural competence, who will bring diverse points of view. Do you want to say something else about that?
Who will bring different perspectives, whether they are the perspectives of the characters or the perspectives of their own background to the characters. So
is your advisory board, has that always existed? Did you have an advisory board from the beginning of your 5 years ago when you...
No, our advisory board is only about a year old. And as we...
How did you come to the need for that?
I think as we started expanding what we were doing, Carol and I started with one script and one show. She wrote a play. I directed the play. And we got some free theater space, and we asked friends to do our tech for us. And then very suddenly, oh, we should do this again. And the more we did it, the more we learned, and hopefully the better we've gotten. But as we're looking at it, there's a lot of questions that we are not equipped to answer by ourselves, and a lot of cultural things that we are not authorities on. And so we asked people that we respect to form an advisory board to help us with questions of theatricality, with questions of, what would you say, cultural competency?
Yeah, and just also connections with the wider Bay Area theater professional community.
Right. So that's a sitting board. I mean, that's a sitting group of people that review. How often do you mount performances?
Usually or twice a year.
Uh-huh. So they would be the same people considering each, or do you put on people for specific performances?
We have associate artists that we bring in to help us with seasons sometimes. So we've had temporary people, Lily Tung Crystal, who's big in San Francisco theater.
And about to be in
Minnesota theater, yes. And she was an advisor to us during 1 year of performances, and she directed for us and has worked with us. That was understood to be a temporary thing, and we formed the advisory board. It's not understood to be temporary, but of course we ask people who...
Now, since you've been obviously planning this for years, I mean,
no,
because you said...
I started doing the research. I just fell down a rabbit hole and started doing the research and kept not having had time to write the play. And then at the end of September, we were discussing what... We had a slot at Laval Subterranean to do a show this summer, and we were discussing what to do. And Libby said, I want you to write that play about the witch trials. And I said, no, I can't do it. There's no way I can have a finished play without time for development workshops and all that usual stuff. No way. Can't do it.
I'm very
persuasive.
Then
I changed my mind.
But now, I mean, the issue of how she was kidnapped or the rape of underage women is, as they say, torn from the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
So was that just implicit in the play? It certainly, I'm sure you don't make any jokes and throw in the name Epstein in there, mm-hmm. but is it just, is that something that audiences will be thinking about when they see this?
I think so. It's certainly something that we've been thinking about in the rehearsal room. And we talk about it pretty frequently. And every time that we've done a preview event or a talk back or anything, one of the actors brings it up within about 10 minutes and about how raw it feels to talk about. One of the things that happens over the course of the play is that Tituba is separated from her child. And it's a very touching moment that the actress feels very deeply when she talks about it. Other things that happen are, of course, she was separated from her family when she was a child. And it's
Tituba.
Yeah. And none of us have forgotten what we're talking about for a second,
right.
I would say.
Sure at every talk back someone must mention, I mean, you can't hear the word witch hunt without thinking about you-know-what.
Yes, so. I feel that you-know-who is advertising our play with every day in the newspaper. Another thing that in the at the height of the witch trials of the panic, there were 150 or 200 people in jail, in a jail that was meant for far fewer people.
Oh, and that's for an incredible list of issues.
We thought going into this that we would make certain choices theatrically to emphasize the connections with the present moment. But as it turns out, we've just kept it period and just kept it historical. And the connections make themselves. And it's a very intimate space. It fits only about 50 people. And the way Elizabeth has staged the play, the actors are performing in spaces that aren't obviously the stage all the time, so that, you know, they're kind of coming in behind you and around you, and you really feel like you've been transported to Salem Village. And the set design is also fantastic.
One last question, which you could each answer separately, is it, as a playwright first, is it harder to retell an old story than tell a new one?
Well, I personally am rather bad at plotting. So I have stolen most of my plays, the stories. The first professional show that I had done, which was at the Magic Theater many, many years ago, was a retelling of the Book of Genesis.
Uh-huh.
It was Adam and Eve.
And
so I prefer
gritty,
steal plots.
Uh-huh. And do you think it's harder? I mean, have you seen The Crucible? And is it harder to start with a blank slate in your head? I mean, I'm sure your head is never a blank slate. But.
I'm not sure of that, so thank you. This play was really different thematically from The Crucible. In a lot of ways, it's a reaction against The Crucible. And it was certainly something that we talked about in the designers' meetings of how much do we want this to look like The Crucible, and while we're at it, how much do we want this to look like the first grade Thanksgiving play with the buckles on the hats and everything, because that's what it gets immediately evoked. I would say the Crucible, knowing that story, didn't influence me very much about how this play got staged. It was really exciting for me to tell this story as a new story and to tell this from a totally new point of view. And what can we do so that people don't fall into the same ideas that The Crucible brings them?
Yeah. Yeah. So Arthur Miller would hate it, right?
One hopes.
Not necessarily. He probably appreciated good theater, and I'm sure this is good theater,
yes.
too.
Yes. Thank you so much. We've been talking to Carol Lashoff, who is the playwright of Witch Hunt, and the director, Libby Vega. They are partners in Those Women Productions, and it's going to open tomorrow and run through August 4th at Lavelle's Subterranean Theater in Berkeley.
Tickets available through Brown Paper Tickets.
Witch Hunts, I was about to say, get a good name as opposed to, you know, whose use of it, but witch hunts never have a good name. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Not to us, not unto us, Lord.
Not to us, not unto us, Lord.
But glory to thy name afford.
But glory to thy name afford.
For thy mercy, for thy truth's sake.
For thy mercy, for thy truth's sake.
The heathen, wherefore should they say?
On Potrero Hill, beginning tomorrow, the Bay Area Playwrights Festival will be raging. Is that a good word? Until July 28th. There are 60 people involved in these performances of six plays. And we're here today talking with Amy Mueller. Is Mueller, yes?
Yes, it is.
Who has been with the Playwrights Festival for 19 years and is leaving after this festival.
That is correct.
And we're talking to Candrice Jones, whose play is Flex and will be performed on the 20th and 28th.
Right, yes.
And Christopher Oscar Pena, whose How to Make an American Son is going to be performed July 21st and 26th. Okay. So, Amy, what do you look for in plays that you're trying to decide will become part of the festival? Plays that you're choosing is the simple way to say that.
Well, first of all, Playwrights Foundation is a new play development center. We work with writers as they're developing the work. We are a non-producing playwright development center, essentially, and offer writers resources to take their plays to the next level of their development. So the festival is actually a festival of plays in process.
So this is an all-year-round program?
It is.
Yes.
Yes. We do readings throughout the entire year. We also have a group of 10 local resident playwrights who have a four-year residency at Playwrights Foundation, and they're pursuing career goals that we support.
So I read that there are 700 submissions for the six plays that are going to be chosen.
Yes.
Those are from people not only who have been working with the festival year-round, but also from outsiders?
Right. Yeah, all over the country. Uh-huh. We get plays from all over the country, and some actually international.
Do you look at them as musical auditions are blind so that you can't see?
Yes.
Do you look at them that way, too?
The first round of reading is blind.
Uh-huh.
And so in terms of the selection of the work that we're doing each year on the festival, which is kind of one of our big cornerstone program. It's our most public program. We're looking for a singular voice, and we're looking for voices of writers who have not yet fully found their place in the American theater. They're on their way. They're in, and the writers are like Candace and Christopher, who are here today with us, are in different places in their careers, definitely, but still, in one way or another, still finding their way to becoming known in a large scale.
So, Candace. That's a perfect lead into what I was going to ask you.
Right.
Is this work done, or are these the first performances? Are you expecting that changes will be made?
Oh, changes will definitely be made. this isn't the first workshop for the play. The play was actually workshopped last year.
Let me interrupt you for a second, and we should tell, it's so interesting what the play is about, and why don't you tell that in a sentence or two before you.
Okay, great. The title of my play is Flix. It is a play set in rural Arkansas in the late 90s. And it is a play about five teenage girls who all have different outlooks on life, but they all have one common goal, to win the state basketball championship, but a few of them want to go further and want to play professional basketball in the WNBA. And the play really captures how the effects of living in rural Arkansas, small southern town, with issues of friendship, teenage identity, sexuality, poverty, all affect one's goals and aspirations. Yeah.
And Christopher, I should have all asked you. Is it okay if I call you by your first name?
Call me whatever you want.
If it's not, I'll just suck it right up and say. So when did you start writing your play? How did it wind up here? And tell us a little about its relevance to the current immigration situation.
Yeah, the play I started about 3 years ago was a commission from Yale Rep on the East Coast. And I actually grew up in the Bay Area. I grew up in San Jose. So Amy was talking about how our careers are at different places. I've had sort of a national career, but I've never been actually brought back to do a reading or production here. So it's really worthwhile for me to be home. But the play is about basically the relationship between an immigrant father who becomes a corporate CEO and his young son, and how class and privilege begin to affect the relationship. And it's really my sort of political sort of response to how I think our country is so divided right now. And, you know, our president likes to basically talk about people of color as being rapists and murderers and illegals and all these horrible things. But the reality is, when we succeed, a lot of white Americans don't like that either. So we're sort of damned if we do, damned if we don't. And so the play really explores what that means for a generation of people of color who are born here and are as American as anybody else.
Yeah. So in choosing the plays, do you choose them yourself?
I do.
Mm-hmm. You do. You
ultimately
are the sole judge.
Well, not the sole judge.
I mean,
not at all.
But the deciding.
I'm the arbiter, the final arbiter.
Okay.
Let's put it that way.
Kind of. Yeah. Sorry.
But we have a very large national reading committee, very large, like over 50 people. Review each script, and every script that's submitted is read by two different people. And if the scores are widely divergent, it is read by a third person, to sort of a tiebreaker. And
yeah,
then we winnow down the selection to semifinalists, then to finalists,
yeah,
and then usually there's a group of about 12 plays from which we create the actual six-play festival. And a lot of different aspects of what we're looking for go into that. I mean, we have a commitment to do to local writers and to working with some local writers on the festival. So there can never be less than two local writers on the festival. We also have a commitment to emerging writers, especially writers who have just graduated from a writing program or are of that level in their work. They don't actually have to be in a in an upper level writing program.
Are you looking for a variety in the mix of the six plays that will be
very much
chosen?
So. Yeah. So these plays are, while they do thematically tie together, it wasn't the theme that drove the choice. The theme emerged after we made the choice of the right of the plays, and but each of these plays are aesthetically very different from one another. They're also from very various cultural and ethnic viewpoints. They are from different. There are different kinds of stories that are being told. We have one story that takes place in the future. It's more of an apocalyptic, you know, vision of maybe what it might be like now, but not. There's an historical drama that takes place during Jim Crow. There, you know, the plays really cover a very wide swath of subjects, but they all tie together.
And while the festival is going on, do the playwrights interact with each other during the day when they're not performance times? Do you, and do you, well, one answer, two guys answer it one at a time. Do you learn from each other?
Well, of course. Our experience with each other actually began with the retreat last week in which we all gathered in one place. And all the playwrights had the wonderful task of reading our plays out loud to an audience of 30 other theater professionals. And we gave each other feedback on our plays. And I personally feel like I received very, very valuable feedback, not only from other playwrights, but from directors and dramaturgs who are also involved in the process. And
You asked earlier about the stages of our plays. I would say that mine is like 95% done. There is rewriting to be done, but I feel like it's almost there. But for me, the biggest incentive to being here was really reconnecting with the Bay Area and meeting a lot of the playwrights and directors who are here. And just having grown up here, working with people that I grew up watching and who I haven't actually worked with. Sean San Jose is the star of my, one of the stars of my reading, and he is an actor that I met when I was 18 years old, who was a mentor, and now is like a close friend doing my piece. So for me, it was really about coming back to reconnect with this place that made me an artist to begin with.
How exciting. How fun. Does it feel good?
It feels amazing. It feels really great.
That's great. Candrice, I just wanted to ask you one thing really quickly because we're almost out of time, but has your work been performed? Has the Flex been performed at all in Arkansas, where you're from?
It has not. Like Chris said, he's never received a production in the Bay Area. I have not received a production in my home state at all. So
you must be so curious about the reception to these works in different places.
Well, yes, and to be honest, the theater environment in Arkansas, which is one reason why I'm grateful for opportunities like this, the theater environment in Arkansas does not allow for new play development. So with that being said, we playwrights like me in Arkansas seek out opportunities elsewhere or make our own opportunities in our state. It hasn't been performed in Arkansas, but I look forward to the day in which it will be.
But projects like this are kind of unifying the playwrights all around the country.
And
creating a kind of mechanism for everybody to share their ideas.
Definitely. And we do have a program for theater professionals really quickly. So the second weekend of the festival, we bring in professionals from around the country and locally. We offer them passes to the entire festival and travel stipends so that producers can see the work of these younger writers.
I will also just add that even though the playwrights are from different places, we all advocate for each other after we leave this place. So mm-hmm. I think that grows community and awareness of the plays.
Great. I thank you so much. I wish there were more time to talk,
sure.
But there's not. And you've been listening to people participating in the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, the founder, Amy Mueller, who will be leaving, and I didn't get to ask you anything about that, but Candrice Jones, whose Flex is going to be playing. This is at the Potrero Stage on Potrero Hill. Flex is playing July 20th and 28th. And Christopher Oscar Pena, who's How to Make an American Son, is playing July 21st and 26th. So you can look at the website for the Bay Area Playwrights.
The website is playwrightsfoundation.org.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That beautiful music is to introduce Peter Robinson, who's Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large. And one of the three movies he's going to talk about right now is a documentary, yes, about Pavarotti.
Yeah, hi, Leah. Good to see you here. Hi. And that indeed is the great voice of the tenor, Luchino Pavarotti, who died just over 12 years ago of pancreatic cancer. And what Ron Howard has done in this, I really enjoyed it, this outstanding documentary, is weave part of his theatrical operatic life together, along with his marriage or marriages, with an S on the end there, and introduce, I think, how the music industry has really come to change not only the way we hear music, the way we see music, but the way we receive music. So it's a fine documentary, and I should add straight away that it's not just for opera buffs. If you're an opera buff, one of the great gifts of Pavarotti was to take the opera into the public place and make it understandable and meaningful to people who weren't necessarily opera fanatics. So this is a documentary that covers his early life. It covers his marriage in Italy and the three children and how he grew up as a singer. But then it begins to move into the various roles he played in the many, many different operas that he appeared in. And I think Ron Howard has a real understanding of the music industry because it covers a period of time when we're moving literally from the stage to what I'm going to call the arena. One of the things you learn in this film are locations. There's a wonderful shot in Hyde Park in London. He's doing an open concert, and there in the front row is Prince Charles and Princess Di, who became personal friends of him. You'll also find him in an unusual location in the Amazon, actually appearing in a theatre where many, many years ago Caruso sang. So suddenly you're getting a kind of geographic tour of how opera comes together. And of course there are the great excerpts from La Boheme and Tosca, and there's background where they give you the story behind the plot so you can keep up to date. Now, the other thing about Pavarotti, I think, is the best thing I can describe it at is his spirit, a generous, kind-hearted, witty, and compassionate person. And this, I think, Ron Howard captures as he brings the personality of the singer together so you can understand many ways some of the ups and downs. At times, the documentary borders on hagiography. It misses out some of the key parts of his life, but then there are other sections with the great tenors Placidingo Domingo, Jose Carreras, where again you are suddenly in that world of wonderful voices. So if you're an opera buff, but if you're somebody who enjoys music, if you really want to get a front row in a seat and some of the best, I'm just going to use the word singing for the sake of a simple phrase, check out the documentary Pavarotti by Ron Howard, and I think you'll have a wonderful, uplifting experience. Yes, indeed. Take me off to, well, let's go. What is a British person doing talking about baseball? And you may very well ask that question since I've just come back from England, been watching cricket. But the movie I'm going to be talking about is called The Spy Behind Home Plate. It is an intriguing documentary based on the life of Mo Berg, who was a baseball player. He was also a multilingualist, spoke at least five different languages, went to Princeton, and indeed, as a part-time job, ended up spying for the OSS, which was the precursor to the CIA. Now, in contemporary times, I think there's a sub-story to this film which we would all do well to follow, because it is essentially an immigrant story. His father, who came to this country in the late 1890 or thereabouts, was a Ukraine Jew, an immigrant, and he grew up in an atmosphere where things were difficult. He went on to Princeton, and not only went to Princeton, he played baseball for Princeton as an undergraduate. He also got enrolled in a Princeton dining club, which was really interesting because, again, it's a time when anti-Semitism was something that people had to live through and with. So Mo Berg had many, many different arrows in his quiver. The documentary draws on a lot of original footage. A lot of people have been interviewed who had different angles on all the different aspects of his life. And what comes out of it, I think, is a great piece of social history, where you begin to see changes happening in the 1920s, in the 1930s, the role of sport. And let me give you one or two small examples. In 1934, he was part of a visiting baseball group that went to Tokyo, went to Japan, and he had already signed up, I want to say, with the OSS, because there was a dramatic scene where he dresses up as a Japanese in a kimono, goes to a hospital to visit the American ambassador's daughter who is ill, but he has under his clothing a Bolex camera. He climbs to the top floor of this hospital, which is the highest building in Tokyo, takes a complete film of the harbour, the layout, and this probably was very useful many years later when the final raid on Tokyo happened. So we're talking about a baseball player. This is what he did. He also spoke nine different languages. He studied Sanskrit at the Sorbonne, and when he arrived in Japan, taught himself Japanese. Now, what does this help you do? Well, he became a star of a radio show called Information Please. He clearly had a photographic memory and was able to answer questions, which not only surprised the questioner, it surprised his mates in the baseball team and also the writers of the encyclopedia. This is a quite extraordinary film. Now, some people think it goes slowly. I actually enjoyed the tripping through the different aspects of his life. I think it's a great piece of social history. The title of the movie is called The Spy Behind Home Plate, and it is a bio of Mo Berg, a baseball player of which we have never seen the likes of since. Anyhow, if we want to finish, as John Cleese would say, now for something totally different. It's called Late Night, and we're in the world of Emma Thompson. This is a feel-good movie about a late-night show hostess, female, get the word female in there, who has to cope with a room of male writers until the person who actually wrote the movie, Mindy Kaling, turns up. And it is a beautiful play on gender, on sexuality, on how, in fact, male writing may be, under certain conditions, become a thing of the past. So let's hope we can hang on for as long as we can. Emma Thompson does a wonderful job and goes through a personal transformation from being the prima donna to understanding people. When I say it's a feel-good film, you'll smile at the end of it, you'll enjoy every moment of it. The title of the film is Late Night. So those are my three recommendations for this week. Enjoy baseball, yes, enjoy Pavarotti, and enjoy Late Night.
Thank you very much, Peter. I've got to get to the movies.
Here we go.
Yeah. Okay, next week on July 25th on Open Air, Kevin Vance is going to be sitting in for David LaTulipe. He'll be talking to actor Francis Jew and director Jeffrey Lowe about a new production of The Language Archive, which opens the 50th anniversary season of TheaterWorks Silicon Valley. And they did win a Tony this year for regional, TheaterWorks did, for regional theater. It's a romantic story. The production will be running through August 4th at the Lucy Stern Theater in Palo Alto. Also, there'll be an interview with composer Jake Heggie, who's probably the most prolific opera composer in the country right now. And he's written an new opera commissioned by the Marilla Opera Program, the first commission ever by Marilla, and it's called If I Were You. It runs August 1st to 6th at the Herbst Theater in San Francisco. Plus, there'll be a conversation with Jeffrey Thomas, who is artistic and music director of American Bach Soloists, because the American Bach Soloists Festival and Academy will begin July 28th through August 11th at the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. So that's on the agenda for next week, July 25th, when Kevin Vance is hosting. That's Open Air for this week. So I'm Leah Garchek. I've been happily sitting in for David LaTulipe. All of our shows can be found on the archive at kalw.org. Just search for the guest name or search for Open Air. And if you have a guest suggestion, send an email to david@kalw.org. He's not here this week, but he'll be watching that email. Thank you, Neil Swinkles, and board engineer Gene Murray. And thank you very much for listening.